You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
So good evening, everyone, and I'm so delighted that you're all able to join us here. You're in for a real treat tonight as we celebrate 30 years of grassroots leadership, and we want to introduce you to the leaders of grassroots leadership and tell you a little bit about their great work. I'm Ann Beeson. I'm the Executive Director of U.S. Programs here at OSI, and I'm going to do my best to try to create a lively conversation. We're hoping it will be a conversation and a kind of lively dialogue. And so we encourage you to jump up, ask a question whenever you feel like doing that. I'm going to do the same thing. And let's jump right into it. Grassroots leadership, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is most importantly a longtime U.S. programs grantee, which we are very proud of. We've been supporting grassroots leadership since 1999. They're a national organization which was founded in 1980 and is a multiracial state and regional community organizing effort to create a progressive movement in the South. Since about 1999, it's been specifically focused on campaigning to abolish for-profit private prisons and immigrant family detention, to stop the ridiculous urge to expand the number of prisons in the United States, and especially in the South, and to try to limit or utterly prevent the ability of local law enforcement agencies to contract with ICE, with immigration enforcement agents. I want to not say too much because these folks to my left can tell you a lot more details about the work. I do want to say that especially for what is still relatively a small organization, grassroots leadership has had a number of very impressive victories, which you're going to hear about, in terms of the impact of the organizing work that they're doing in the South. They are based in Charlotte, North Carolina, and they have chapters in Mississippi, New Mexico, and Texas. And I want to just now introduce these great folks who are with us tonight. First of all, Cy Khan, who is a... who's been working for over 40 years as a civil rights, labor, and community organizer and a musician, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. I have gotten to know Cy, has it just been like a year or two, really, but it feels like longer. And he has stepped down just recently as the founding executive director of the organization, and we are extremely delighted to welcome Donna Redwing, who has just in the last 30 days become the new executive director of grassroots leadership. And Donna is a longtime activist and organizer who's had a number of great positions related to many other movements that we support here at OSI. She was most recently the chief of staff of the Interfaith Alliance and was also at the Gill Foundation for quite a long time. So she's been on the other side of the table like many of us at OSI have been. And we're really looking forward to getting to know you, Donna, as you take the reins of this this terrific organization. One of the reasons that Cy and I connected so quickly was because I have myself a deep passion and belief in the role that art and culture play in advancing social change, and knew that Cy also and grassroots leadership had used culture as a key strategy in their change work, and so we thought it would be terrific to open the evening with having Cy play a song. Thanks.
Labrador Retriever, and it will last until supper time. What if our lives were measured in dog years? Would I still be here? I can't figure it out. So we turn towards home, where supper is waiting. The river flows on, and the geese fly south. And the geese look down at the old railway station. In his imagination, Otis is flying. It's the existential angst of the Labrador Retriever, and it will last until supper time. It will last until supper time.
Actually at a retreat last summer of activists who are using art and culture and social change work, and he and one of his buddies actually volunteered to work with anybody else at the conference to write a song about their movement or their organization. And at first I thought, oh God, this is going to be so awful. You know, they're going to come up with these awful, you know, I don't know. And to my utter amazement and the amazement of everybody else at the conference, they proceeded to write a series of beautiful songs for the organizations and the movements represented at the conference, and just kind of another testament to Cy's leadership and his vision as a musician and an activist both. Cy is going to say a few words about, or maybe more than a few, about the history of grassroots leadership. But before I have him do that, I really want to give Donna a chance to tell us a little bit about what brought you to grassroots leadership. What made you most excited about joining this organization?
Years ago, I bought Cy's organizing book. And I've been organizing for a long time. And his book was my blueprint. I never met him. I just read his book. I cited him all the time. And then, a number of years ago, he heard that I was running for office and called me and said, can I do a fundraiser for you? Well, before the words were even out of his mouth, it was yes, absolutely. And we met in the parking lot of the Senior Resource Center in Evergreen, Colorado. And right away, it was as though we had worked together forever. We raised twice the amount of money we had anticipated. We had a great time. And those of you who know Cy, he kind of hooks you and then he starts reeling you in. So a number of years after that, I found myself serving on the board. I had the great privilege of serving on the board. And if I may, we have three people here that I'd like to say hello to, and I'd like you to. Silky Shah, if you could stand, and Mitty Owens, if you could stand, and Mafruza Khan, if you could stand. These are board members at Grassroots Leadership, and they are in their own right great organizers and advocates for justice. So I'd like to thank them for being here. And so the work at Grassroots Leadership is, for me, like coming home. I've done a lot of national work, but my heart is in the work, the local work. And everything we do is about working with people, being with people, hearing people, and learning from them. Mm-hmm. So how could I say no?
Great. Wonderful. Thank you, Donna. So, Cy, tell us a little bit about what led you to form Grassroots Leadership in 1980, and what were your goals at that time?
Right. Could I say just a few thank yous first?
Absolutely.
All right. So first, you've met three of our extraordinary board members. I also want to recognize some former board members People sometimes say, so what happens after people leave grassroots leadership? One answer is that they become a member of the New York City Council representing the 39th District in Brooklyn. Would you please welcome Brad Lander? Another answer is that they go to work for Demos, a wonderful center for ideas and action here in New York, but also all over the country. And they have just honored me by making me a distinguished senior citizen. They call it a distinguished senior fellow, but I am a distinguished senior. Would you please welcome Cynthia Geyer, former board member of Grassroots Leadership. And I want to recognize, too, Donna Parson and Miles Rappaport. Miles is the executive leadership team at Demos, close friends of 30 years. I want to recognize and thank Judy Green. Judy, where are you? Judy was the first, when we were trying to figure out whether grassroots leadership should take on a campaign to abolish for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers, it was Judy Green who sat in our living room in Charlotte, North Carolina, and persuaded me that, yes, this was the right direction to do. Took a little while to persuade the board, but Judy is a legendary figure in the movement to abolish for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers, and also to make public prisons accountable and humane. So please recognize Judy Green. You know? And then I want to say the most profound thank you to OSI, to the Open Society Institute. They have been partners in a way that no other foundation I've ever worked with has been. I learned very early on that we could say, you know what, we tried it and it was a complete and total failure. And they would say, what's your analysis of how it failed? How do you plan to move forward? Mm-hmm. There are too many OSI people here to recognize them all, but would you all just stand? So would you stand? Right. Okay. In particular, William Johnston, who was our program officer in 1999 and was actually on the National Steering Committee for the Public Safety and Justice Campaign, a national effort. Lenny Noizet, our wonderful program officer, Luisa Taveras. This is a great organization and demonstrates a level of honesty in funding that is very, very rare. And I will tell you that grassroots leadership would not have been able to do what we have done without OSI. That's very real. And of course, Ann Beeson, whom you have met. And we are joined at the Bluegrass. I have to tell you, that when Ann became the director of U.S. programs, you know, and I was, of course, concerned what would her politics be, how would she see privatization, how should we, and I had prepared what I hoped was an eloquent and persuasive speech. And we sat down at a restaurant on 9th Avenue, and Ann said, you don't need to talk to me about grassroots leadership. We know your track record. We're committed. Can we talk about bluegrass music?
I think I know.
And I knew there was a goddess somewhere. Right? So how did this all get started? I come out of the Southern Civil Rights Movement. In my heart, it is always 1965, and I'm always in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in Forest City, Arkansas, named after General Nathan Bedford Forrest, Confederate cavalry leader and founder of the Ku Klux Klan. That is my spiritual home, my political home, and that is what I always go back to in when I try to center myself and remember what it is we are doing. In 1980, during one of several periods of unemployment and relative personal turmoil, and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, and I looked around to see who was left from the civil rights movement and who was left from so many of the wonderful movements that I had played a role in. I worked with the United Mine Workers of America on the Brookside strike in Harlan County. Some of you have seen Barbara Koppel's quite wonderful Academy Award-winning film, Harlan County, USA. I had worked with the Textile Workers Union of America on the J.P. Stevens campaign. Some of you have seen Norma Rae. I am not that organizer. I got there after the film ended, right? And the view from 1980 was very, very different from the view from 1965. The leaders of the civil rights movement had been driven out of the South. So many organizations had been broken, pushed out of existence. And those of us who were left from the Southern movements were spread few and far between. And I thought, what is the source of power that supports and sustains the organizers, the leaders, the organizations, the networks, the coalitions that make progressive change possible and inevitable? And I thought, you know, there should be an organization that does that, that works with anybody, regardless of whether they work with each other, an organization that incorporates the principles of the civil rights movement, but also the principles of the feminist movement, an organization that is open to everybody, and an organization that strives to be internally just and democratic, recognizing how hard that is. I thought it was very important to have an organization that was willing to fail. You know, I'm a historian by training, and I know that many of the great movements of history came about because people took on impossible dreams. This is the history of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, of African Americans in the South who, against the counseling that said, go slowly, said, we've already waited 300 years. We go now. So I thought that there should be an organization that was willing to take on fights that maybe were winnable and maybe weren't. And an organization that modeled a different kind of dynamic, an organization that had a majority of people of color on its board, a majority that had a majority of women on its board, and that became grassroots leadership. We have been shaped by many, many, many people. At this point, we have 30 or more people who have been through us as staff people. They've gone on to do extraordinary things. We have 50 board members over the years. They have gone on to do wonderful things. I hope we have stayed true to that core. And I hope we continue. My wish is, as my wonderful friend and co-worker, Donna Redwing, launches her years as our executive director, I hope that we continue to be an organization that strives to be internally just, that strives to model what it preaches, that is not afraid to fail, that is not afraid to take risks, and that stays on the cutting edge of social justice. We have always said, if another organization can do what we're doing, let's let them do that. If they can do it well and responsible, let's give them that program, that project, that campaign. Let's take on the things that other people do not feel they can take on. So that's how we got started.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Cy. Tell us now, bring us up to 1999 and tell us how it is that you came to the decision at Grassroots Leadership to focus on prison privatization. What was it about that issue that seemed so primary?
Well, some people are still wondering, right? I mean, it was, we didn't come from the criminal justice and prison side, mm-hmm. which is how other organizations got there. We came from the privatization side. In 1994-95, we were going through one of our regular strategic planning processes. And up until that time, we had done mostly organizational development, leadership development, organizer training, and organization building. We were trying to build an infrastructure within the South. I was personally very inspired by some of the work that Miles Rappaport, for example, was doing at Connecticut Citizen Action Group, other citizen action groups that were building statewide power, state as in North Carolina, not as in the state. And I wanted to build those kinds of coalitions in the South, but we didn't have enough building blocks to pull together. So Grassroots Leadership spent many years building other organizations, creating them from the ground up. And then in 1994-1995, two of our board members, June Ralston, who's a longtime labor organizer, and Kathy Howell, who came out of NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League, and has been through many, many movements, a wonderful white working class anti-racist organizer. Both of them said, you know, there are now many organizations that in these 15 years have developed the capacity to do what we do, and they're doing a good job. And at the same time, Grassroots Leadership has internally three or four people who have run national, international, and regional campaigns. That's a rare resource. Maybe we should be doing issue and campaign work. So we made a decision that we should become an issue and campaign organization, and then we started a search for what is an issue that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Among our principles are multiracial democracy, and you can extend that to all the other ways in which we
across the many barriers that divide people from each other. So we're always looking for those issues that cross racial lines, that cross gender lines, that where you can build a very broad-based approach to justice. And at one point in a staff meeting at the Afro-American Center in Charlotte, Reverend James Williams, who was a progressive Pentecostal preacher on our staff, walked in and said, "I've got the issue, it's privatization." And I thought, what's privatization? And as we studied it, what we realized, that privatization is a word almost nobody understands. It's not used in common language. But what it means is that the multinational corporations aren't satisfied with what they've already got. They want it all. They want the rest of it. And they want it so they can sell it back to us. So it is the giving away of the public sector to the for-profit private multinational sector so they can make profit off of selling our democracy back to us. It also has a huge anti-union component to it. It involves the destruction of the public sector unions. And it's devastating to poor people, but it's also devastating to middle-income people. So one of our first campaigns, when we were only doing privatization, was in Georgia, where the state of Georgia had offered to sell its welfare system. Let me repeat that. To sell its welfare system to a privatizing corporation called Maximus. They said, for $5 billion, you can have the Georgia welfare system permanently, right? So that would have been devastating to welfare recipients, but also to the several thousand social workers, almost all of whom were women, a great majority of whom were people of color, many of whom were immigrants, and almost all of whom were the first in their family to get that kind of job, and who were supporting extended families. So they're tremendous ground for coalition. Pardon? George Bush, as governor of Texas, attempted to privatize his entire welfare system. I mean, there was a wholesale, you know, fire sale going on.
Yep.
And still is, by the way.
Yep.
I cannot resist the commercial. You should read The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, by public philosopher, feminist philosopher Elizabeth Minnick, and yours truly. We have been a couple forever and best friends for 50 years, and we were spicing up our very long marriage by writing a book together, but it will tell you more than you ever wanted to know about privatization. Right?
Great. Wonderful.
And at that time, I wasn't even aware that there was such a thing as private prisons. We were looking at education and health care and welfare and child support enforcement, and we were having a national conference. Somebody called up from Tennessee and said, "We're fighting prison privatization. Can we come?" And what we learned from them, and then what we learned as we experimented with, this was experimental. We had said, let's see if we can build permanent organizations around privatization. The unions and many community organizations have done excellent defensive fights. You know, they try to privatize, we try to stop them.
Yeah.
But they didn't build sustaining organizations. We're interested in whether you could build sustaining organizations and coalitions. So we experimented with all of these, but we had said that we would eventually choose one issue, and that would be our major focus. We wanted something that could be regional, and at that time, we weren't even thinking national. That came later. And private prisons, I want to give you my personal take here, right? I think it is no coincidence that the radical increase in incarceration in this country follows the civil rights movement. And I believe it is a counterattack on people of color, particularly African Americans, but also emerging as other people of color. It became a way of when you could no longer, pardon me, use the N-word while running for office, which was what Southern politicians did, when 6 million newly enfranchised black voters, as the result of the 1965 Voting Act, forced Southern white politicians to moderate their language, they discovered that you could talk about immigration, by which everybody white knew we meant people of color. And so here we had gone from 250,000 people in prison in the 70s to, and Judy will give the specific number down to the exact person, we had gone to over 2 million people in prisons, jails, and detention centers. We had gone to a situation where 1 in 3 African-American men in his 20s was either in prison, in prison, jail, or a detention center. 1 out of 3. Entire inner cities were being stripped of their young people. Native American, Latino, Latina, immigrants, and it was becoming this massive industry, and it felt like it was so significant and unheard of, and that somebody needed to take it on, and that mm-hmm. somebody became us.
That's wonderful. I'm thinking we should get to the film, don't you think? Bring it kind of up to the present. This is a major focus still, is still the major focus of Grassroots Leadership's work, and you're going to have the chance to see a terrific film clip in a minute, and Donna is going to introduce that, so
sure.
Why don't you?
When we say family detention center, and we're talking specifically about the T. Don Hutto Family Detention Center. First of all, T. Don Hutto was one of the co-founders of the Correction Corporation of America. Mm-hmm. Family Detention Center, what does that mean? Family Immigrant Detention Center. It means last year 512 beds, 512 detainees, and more than half of them were children. There were men, women, infants, toddlers, elementary school children, and teenagers. Children. Imagine children being fitted for what they called scrubs, mm-hmm. code word for prison uniform. Imagine a child allowed only 1 hour of recreation a day and spending the rest of their time in a cell with an open toilet and sink. Imagine a child not allowed toys because those toys were dangerous. Imagine mothers writing the children's prison number on their arm because the 4:30 wake-up call was just a little too early for children to stand up and recite their number. The ACLU had to sue T. Don Hutto Family Detention Center in order to let the children wear pajamas to bed instead of prison uniforms and to allow them to have crayons. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about a family detention center, that's what we're talking about. You'll see. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the children, the families of detainees in prison. Grassroots Leadership, along with other folks on the ground, some of the most authentic stakeholders, family members whose other families were in jail, people living in the town who were sold a bill of goods thinking that this detention center would bring wonderful jobs to the community and didn't really quite get that they were going to be imprisoning children. So we worked with folks on the ground. Last August, Cy and our Texas organizers were sitting together trying to figure out, you know, what's our strategy for the next 2 or 3 years, because it would take at least that long for us to close this institution, or at least to close it as a family detention center. And as they were strategizing, Bob Leibel, who is our great organizer in Texas, looked at his iPod, because that's what people do when they're talking to somebody else, looked at the iPod and saw that the administration had decided not only to close this as a family detention center, but to withdraw RFPs for 3 more family detention centers. We know that we don't have a lot of things to celebrate in this work. There are not a lot of huge victories, but this was stunning.
And
so what we'd like is for you to hear Cy's song about the T. Don Hutto Family Detention Center, and then we have this extraordinary film that will tell you everything you need to know about it.
Minnie, how many times have you seen it? Come on, you don't remember. So, and I want to say in doing this, that this, Ann and I share, as she said earlier, this passion. Minnie shares this too, a passion for the role of art and culture in social justice. So this is Bob Leibel, who was just mentioned, and who worked with a Soros Justice Fellow, Lisana Santibanez, our third Soros Justice Fellow, all of them wonderfully creative, and I'll talk about them later. But Bob called up and said, okay, we need a campaign song. That's your job. And there's somewhere on YouTube, there I am standing in front of the Tidonhoe Immigrant Family Detention Center playing the song. Can you all hear that out there? A man called T. Don Hutto must have been some kind of man, 'cause he sure got a man-sized share of fame. It's not just anybody gets their name put on a building where children are held prisoner in their name. The town of Taylor, Texas, just an hour from Austin, but when you're there, you're in a world away. Look inside the prison yard, just beyond the chain link fence, you will see young children at their play. You might well stop and ask yourself, what have these young children done to be sentenced to such painful loss and fear? It's all because their mom or dad was caught here without documents, like 12 million others living here. Now you may think all immigrants should go back where they came from, and if they won't, hell, let them rot in jail. But if it was your own daughter in a cell at T. Don Hutto with your grandchild in her arms, how would you feel? What would you say if your own two were 4 or 6 or 8 year old was growing up in prison like these kids? Since when in these United States do we put kids in prison because of what we say their parents did? Call it family detention, say we do it for the children. You're lying to yourself down to the roots. But call it playing politics with children's lives and sanity, you're getting somewhat closer to the truth. So if you're down in Austin, take the highway out to Taylor. Bring some good friends with you for the ride. Even wear a flag pin to show you still believe in the dream for which so many fought and died. Step out onto the highway, turn to face the prison, stare at those walls till you forget your name. Say a prayer for T. Don Hutto, say a prayer for all those children. Close your eyes and hang your head in shame.
Come back up and tell us how it ends, please. We know it has a happy ending. You told us that already. Come on back up.
Yeah, you saw all except the last 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 2 minutes, they give credit to Gresham. We can do that on our own.
Yes. Tell us a little more, either Cy or Donna, about like how what happened at the end of the process. You jumped right to the punchline at the beginning, Donna, and explained, which is such great news, that there was a decision to close it. But that was after much, much work on the part of you all.
Let me read what, and I just pulled this afternoon because Cy said, find what the New York Times said.
Yep.
And on August 5th, right after it closed, the New York Times said, and I quote, "The decision to stop sending families there, T. Don Hutto, and to set aside plans for 3 new family detention centers is the Obama administration's clearest departure from its predecessor's immigration enforcement policies." Mm-hmm. And that was the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
absolutely.
I think, yeah. Is this, okay.
Yeah.
Grassroots leadership is a tiny organization, right? We think we have 6.5 paid staff. We have a Roman Catholic priest loaned to us half-time by his order. We've got a couple of organizing interns. We've got a lot of volunteers. But fundamentally, we're tiny. And so what we have to do is figure out campaigns that depend on allies and on leveraging. One of the things that I learned very early on is that if you don't have to get credit for what you do, you can win twice as often. Mm-hmm. So when we build partnerships, we can say to another organization, look, you can put your name on the report even though we wrote it, or you can be a partner with us, and we'll talk about you. We'll help you raise money. We do these creative partnerships so that we can leverage our really very small size. And that's what we did in this. First, I think our strategic analysis was right. We figured out that we decided that this was so radically embarrassing, even to the Bush administration. We started the campaign under the Bush administration. We thought they were going to hardline forever on immigration, on immigrant detention. But we thought that a constant drumbeat about you have 2-year-olds in prison and the only thing their parents did was be caught in this country without documents, we didn't think they could stand that heat. And then we also thought that this would lift up the conditions of immigrants in general. I mean, we always planned to go from this to the whole question of immigrant detention, period. No one should be detained for the condition of being an immigrant. It's a civil violation. It's a minor violation. It's, in essence, at the level of a traffic ticket. But we thought that by choosing this particular issue that is so egregious, that is so wrenching, that we would have real leverage and sustaining power. And we did, and by the way, this whole campaign was created by 2 organizers in their very early 20s, Bob Leibel and Luis Sanla Santibanez, working out of Texas. They put it together. And there were some wonderful things, like when, you know, the Obama administration had its first 100 days, we had a campaign called 100 Days, 100 Actions. And so we had people all over the country doing actions. We used a Facebook petition. We had 77,000 signatures on it very quickly. We know that that's nothing like a petition that's gone hand-to-hand, but it leverages media. This was wonderful. And this then resulted in coverage. So it was, in some ways, there's a certain level of smoke and mirrors here, to be honest, right? Mm-hmm. But if you smell the smoke and you look at yourself in the mirror, that can be effective. We also had a wonderful community presence, which I think is very important, because so often something like this is done in the name of people, but not with people. And you saw the community activists. This happened every week for years. Mm-hmm. A weekly vigil at the prison. Every time they did something, we had vigils across Texas. We had walks. But more and more, the community came over to the issue and started to understand. And we came very close, for example, to forcing a vote by the county to break the contract. We ultimately lost, but close enough to keep the pressure on. So I think it was... I think it was absolutely understanding what Margaret Mead said, which is that never doubt that a small group of determined people can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has. I actually disagree with it's the only thing that ever has, but I like the first part.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and just to show, just to build on what Cy said about the way that they work in partnership with other organizations, and this is, of course, part of our theory of change at OSI, which is you got to, like, use every tool in the toolkit. So, you know, we were supporting grassroots leadership. We had a number of Soros Justice Fellows that or former Soros Justice Fellows that worked on this. Cy mentioned Luisana Santibanez, who was so amazing in organizing other families that had family members in detention around this issue. We also, of course, supported the ACLU, and you saw my dear old colleague, I used to be at the ACLU, Lisa Graybill, who worked on that case. Vanita Gupta, who was another former justice fellow and really was one of the first lawyers to go there and talk on the ground. And the point is, it's absolutely critical to support all of these kinds of strategies and to hope that they, bear some fruit. And then share the credit when we have a great success like this. So let's talk a little bit about what stands out for both of you in terms of the values that are most important in the work that grassroots leadership does. Donna?
Since I've been here all of 30 days, as opposed to his 30 years, I will begin.
But you were on the board?
Yes, I was. Absolutely. I was. I think that we are highly effective radicals. That's what I think. I think it's a big deal to be who we are, where we are. Taylor, Texas, Houston, Texas, Charlotte, North Carolina, mm-hmm. Montezuma, New Mexico. And then we're looking at other places. I don't know if you know Arizona. The legislature in Arizona is talking about privatizing all of its prisons. And even more frightening for me, the state legislature is talking about privatizing the task of execution.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
So where in those places, we stand where the Klan is active, we stand where there are armed border militia, we stand where there are white supremacists, we stand where children are put in detention, and where families die in the desert. Who we are and where we are as organizers and as activists, I think, is a radical act of democracy and a core value for grassroots leadership.
That was awesome.
Absolutely.
I think we're also great negotiators, and we have things about which we're non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. We are not negotiable about reproductive choice. We refuse to take money that sets those kinds of conditions. We are not negotiable about the rights of LGBTQ people, and we are very outspoken on that. I once sent a newsletter back to the staff member who was doing it because it didn't say something about the struggle for LGBTQ rights. You have to be people and constituencies count on us. We are a unionized organization. We stand in solidarity with our sisters and brothers in the unions. We believe that every immigrant has a right to be here. We're not negotiable on these things. And I think, like Donna said, you know, we had a great. We were just in Berkeley. In Berkeley, we could say anything, and you know, but in the town.
But in Berkeley, when we told our story to smart, radical, progressive, educated people, most of them had never heard it before.
Yeah.
So we not only have to educate people outside of our circles, we need to educate in our circle.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm. So, and I want to, the other thing is, I think that we fight to win. We don't take something, we will take on unwinnable. The problem is, I got very confused presenting this because I was explaining, as I said at the beginning, we take on those things that we don't believe can be easily won, and then we win them. So it's very confusing. But I wanted to do a very quick list of victories that 6.5 people have done in 10 years.
Terrific.
And in every case, we had at least one lead organization that was our major partner, and I want to name them and the people that were part of them. In our Sodexo campaign, initiated by No More Prisons, a new national student organization, we forced the largest food service company in the world, Sodexo Alliance, to divest, who were the largest shareholders in Corrections Corporation of America, to divest their 8% share to withdraw their director from the board of directors. It was an international campaign. We even had a floating picket line on in Paris, past their headquarters. We drew straws to see who goes. Kevin Prentice, a Soros Justice Fellow, created that campaign, brought it to us. Kevin and Silke, Silke Shaw, we were asked by the Yale Graduate Teaching Assistant Union. They were doing something called the Farallon campaign to force one of these smoke and mirrors investment companies to divest from private prisons. They asked us to take it national. We took it national. They divested. They claimed our campaign had nothing to do with the decision to divest. I'm working with Mississippi Alliance of State Employees, which is a CW Communications Workers of America affiliate. We closed the Delta Correctional Facility, a 500-bed private prison.
And Gail Tyree, who was a staff person there, when she was interviewed by the media, she said, "We beat them with a slingshot."
It's true. We in Memphis, working with the Mid South Peace and Justice Center, we stopped the construction of what would have been the world's largest for-profit private jail. In West Virginia, we have kept it private prison free for 10 years. We've beaten down at least half a dozen attempts to privatize. We've also stopped the expansion of the public prison system and helped get a statewide alternative incarceration program supported by the governor that provides DAIC report centers to every West Virginian. Working with the Juvenile Justice Project Louisiana, another wonderful Soros Justice Fellow, Josiel Rivera, helped them close Tallulah, an absolutely notorious juvenile facility that was twice profiled on CBS 60 Minutes, too. And those are just some of the highlights. I mean, I think that, you know, that what Donna says, we're effective radicals. We don't stake out the mainstream positions. There are great organizations that carry the mainstream. You know, Families Against Mandatory Minimums is one, CURE. You know, there are many organizations covering that ground. We took on private, because people often say, why did you take on private prisons when there's so many other prison and criminal justice issues? And our answer was, that was the one that nobody else was doing. Mm-hmm. And I always say, it's not any more important than anything else in this field. It simply was that no one else was doing it. And at the beginning, by the way, a lot of people came down hard on us because they said, you know, the public prisons are terrible. And furthermore, we had strange allies. We were working with prison guards in the public sector unions that represent correctional employees. We caught all kinds of flack for that. And I think today people have said, well, it was a risky strategy, but in fact, it had its levels of effectiveness. But I think that the question of why we did it because nobody else was.
That's great. So we want to quickly get to Q&A because that's always the funnest part of these things. But a couple more things before that. And first is, Cy, it would be terrific if you could hold up at least.
Yes.
But we're hoping also read a short excerpt from your latest book.
Yeah. I think a short excerpt would cut into the Q&A at this point.
Okay, then let's hold off and just hold up the book.
Mm-hmm. Because our national headquarters is in the South, we have wonderfully gracious Southern manners. So we want to thank all of you for coming tonight, and we have party favors. The party favor is my latest book called, don't know that I like the cover, but it sure stops them in the aisles, man. It's psychedelic, right? So the title is Creative Community Organizing, A Guide for Rabble-Rousers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice, right? And on the back, it has a quote from Donna Redwing, Executive Director of Grassroots Leadership, sandwiched between Amy Goodman and Dave Wellstone, who is Paul Wellstone's son and the co-chair of the Wellstone Alliance. It actually has forewords by Angela Davis and Jim Hightower, and it is yours as a gift from us for coming tonight. Just please take a copy of our 30th anniversary newsletter. Take lots of copies. We have lots of them.
And sandwiched between the book and the newsletters are some lovely envelopes.
Wonderful. So before we open it up to Q&A, Donna, just tell us a little bit about your future plans. What are you thinking about right now? What are you envisioning for grassroots leadership in the next?
Well, we're in the middle of our Standing for Justice tour. I think we've been in 6 states in 4 weeks, so we have a little bit to go. So I will survive that. And then I think you know, we need to survive these economic times. They're tough. Cy, 30 years ago, had a vision for this organization, and the board and Cy, working together with staff, that vision has been kind of organic, and it's moved and grown and changed. But at our core, we will abolish for-profit prisons. That's what we'll do. We believe that the buying and selling of human beings is wrong, and that's what for-profit incarceration does. And I think what we need to do is continue to learn from the front lines.
Great.
We have some great skills, lots of history, but every time we're on the ground working with people who are part of the issue, and sometimes even part of the problem, we learn. So I hope that we stay radical, we stay true to the values that we've talked about, and that we never stop learning from the people who can teach us so much more than we can teach them.
Wonderful. So really, really eager to welcome your questions. So questions for Donna and Cy. Go ahead. Yeah, if you don't mind to use the mic, it'd be great.
And we've been asked to ask people who ask questions to say who they are.
Thank you. My name is Elena Sassauer. I'm director and co-founder of a partisan nonprofit citizens organization called Center for Judicial Accountability. Mm-hmm. I was a guest of Correctional Corporation of America, CCA. So I was incarcerated on a disruption of Congress charge. So I have some sense of how they operate, and I can appreciate the important work you're doing, because there are abuses. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that, as a concept, privatization is wrong. If you have a superior service, I mean, I went through D.C. jail. Mm-hmm. D.C. jail is not run by the Correctional Corporation of America. Mm-hmm. And that is a horror. When I went to a facility run by CCA, I thought I had died and gone to heaven by comparison. Mm-hmm. So my question is, are you opposed to a superior service if it can be rendered by a private entity?
Mm-hmm. Let me start.
Isn't the goal humane care?
When the end game is profit, when a decision about what kind of food you put on the tray, or whether or not a pregnant woman has prenatal care, or in the case of family detentions, children have what they need. When every decision is driven by profit, I have to believe, and we at Grassroots Leadership have to believe, that the safety of the detainees, the care, all of that will be lessened. The enormous profit, if you were to, and I do this almost on a daily basis, I Google private prisons and then the name of the state that I'm in to see what comes up, and page after page of why for-profit prison is a good investment come up. And way, way down the line, we hear about what people are doing for the safety and care of people who are incarcerated. So at Grassroots Leadership, we believe that for-profit incarceration is wrong.
As philosophically, you're opposed
yes.
to it. Mm-hmm. But certainly there can be standards that can be imposed upon a a private corporation that is going to be charged with such an important responsibility. No?
Mm-hmm. Judy, do you want to pitch in on this one?
But thank you for the question, because we have gotten this.
It's a great question.
Yeah, I want to ask
again,
Judy Green if she would respond.
You know, I did, one of the first things I did in researching privatizations was to compare a CCA prison in Western Minnesota with three comparable public prisons in that state. Now, Minnesota is a state that still invests a fair amount of money in their prisons. But the corporation was endlessly telling everyone that, you know, their prison was better, cheaper, more wonderful, whatever. I took a team of law students from the University of Minnesota and invaded that prison for a couple of weeks, interviewing prisoners, looking through the records of the licensing agency, which is the state of Minnesota. And on every measure, they didn't measure up to the degree of care, the programming. I mean, to give you an example, in terms of education, in the public prisons of Minnesota, if you're enrolled in the school, you go full time. Your teacher is credentialed. And if you graduate from a vocational training program, you get the same certificate that you would if you went to the local tech school. So you're on an even plane with free world people when you get out of prison. In the Prairie Correctional Facility, which was actually closed recently, that CCA ran, an education assignment was half the day. None of the teachers were credentialed. And when you graduated from the horticulture program or the small machine repair program, you got a certificate that said CCA on the top that they were like putting out of the word processing in the warden's office. That was one example, but when I went to the state educational authorities to look at GED attainment, one-third better, higher proportion of people in the school system getting GEDs. That was like one measure. We had 15. In every case, the private prison was less safe, the services were less professionally delivered, and the prisoners told us they did not feel safe. Now, there have been a number of studies done by people who are working on grants from the private prison industry that have found that, you know, services are great and the cost is cheaper. But I don't think there is a study that's done by an objective social scientist or by a government agency that, you know, structured the study properly that hasn't found the same kind of findings that we did. The national the Bureau of Justice Assistance Study that Jim Austin did 10 years ago found 65% higher rate of prisoner-on-prison violence and 50% higher rate of attacks on prison staff by prisoners. I mean, that's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can't argue with your experience, and certainly our public jails and prisons are not what we want them to be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the jury's in.
Yeah. And it just seems to me that there should be standards imposed. It should be regulated. And if it were properly regulated and monitored, I'm not sure that it could not provide an equivalent to greater service.
Yeah, and I just want to say, too, that there are a lot of different advocacy organizations who take slightly different or, you know, positions on this. And some of them are working at the very, you know, at least to impose the kinds of standards you require. Grassroots Leadership has a different analysis. Again, part of our theory of change at OSI is actually to support a range of organizations, some of which may have more radical, to use Donna's own word, solutions to what we're seeing, you know, as the challenges. So I definitely think it's a very good point to raise. I do want to make sure we get to some other questions. William, do you have a question? Please.
Hi, my name is William Johnson. I'm a program officer here at OSI. On the issue of kind of unlikely allies, Sai, you mentioned in the beginning that correctional officers unions were part of the campaign, the early campaign. I was, you know, related to that campaign a little bit, so I know some of this, but I was 10 years, it was 10 years ago when I was involved, so I was 10 years less experienced.
It was when William was 12.
Can you talk a little bit about why? Why was it that correctional officers were interested in ending private prisons?
Sure. I mean, this, you know, part of what the economic model for private prisons is you cut costs in order to increase profits. The prisons are, by and large, a very labor-intensive industry. And so the typical private prison pays half of what the typical public prison pays. They resist unionization. There aren't workers and benefits. So as a result, turnover is 2 to 3 to 4 times what it is in the public prison industry. But if you had private prisons everywhere, then working people who have made a decent living for their families as prison employees, it's not, by the way, it's not just prison guards. The prisons are small cities. They employ GED teachers, they have therapists, they have physical therapists, they have medical personnel, food preparation personnel, counselors, psychologists, a whole range of people. And as has happened, whenever privatization takes place, the public employee unions are destroyed. The wages, salaries, living conditions of the public employees are forced downward, and the economy of the places that they come from is undercut. Mm-hmm. As a public sector employment, the public prisons employed roughly 500,000 people in this country, and some 60% of them were union members. So they all, stood to lose their jobs, because when a prison gets taken over, they let everybody go and then rehire at half the rate. So yeah, so it was, you know, and it wasn't like all of the correctional officers were enlightened progressives, but some of them were. And I think it's just, in difficult issues, we have got to figure out how to build things that are very broadly based, and there are moments of serious discomfort in doing that.
Wonderful, thanks.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Mafruza Khan, and I'm a grassroots leadership board member. And can I comment? I don't really
please,
have a question.
Please.
And it's a relation to this issue of standards, mm-hmm. whether it's... I think there are two levels here. Mm-hmm. One is what works. Mm-hmm. That's fundamentally what we're interested in, whether we want to call it being bipartisan, whether we want to call it, you know, apolitical, whatever, what works. That's one level. And the other question is at a more philosophical level is what's up for profit. Mm-hmm. And so certain things, I'm not an ideologue. I'm not against corporations or privatization. It's more a matter of what works. Mm-hmm. And depending on the context, sometimes you can have public-private partnerships. Sometimes you can have civil service organizations providing. So you know, and if you look across the world, not just only in the U.S., you know, it can work in different models. Mm-hmm. So that's not what I want to go into. But the idea of what is up for profit, mm-hmm. and that's where grassroots leadership, I think, plays a really critical role. Mm-hmm. Because fundamentally, something like incarceration or something like education, that which is a fundamental human right, and, you know, sort of it could be from size, snitch, sort of, you know, historical background, it's a civil rights issue. You know, I consider myself to be a product of globalization. Mm-hmm. I'm a naturalized citizen. I consider myself to be a transnational citizenship. So I don't believe in the immigration debate in theory. I believe in global citizenship and free migration. So I guess the point then is, what is up for profit? You know, certain things you can make fair profits in certain kinds of business enterprises. Mm-hmm. But something that relates to incarceration, education, or some very fundamental human rights cannot be up for profit. Mm-hmm. And so there is a moral and ethical basis, because we are talking, fundamentally, it's about values yeah. and principles.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you. And I actually want to ask a kind of follow-up question that's connected, which is just, you mentioned earlier, Cy, that you all did consider looking at other sectors we continue to see the same trend towards privatization. Maybe talk a little bit about the parallels that you see, having now focused on prison privatization, with other sectors like education, where you're seeing these same trends, and what more we all need to be doing about those.
Yeah. I would ask, so I think maybe Miles might comment, because Demos has done
Absolutely.
A great deal of work on privatization. Partly in response, there is the theoretical model is, from the privatizers, is business can always do it better, and that we can deliver services more efficiently, we're accountable to our shareholders, We have a bottom line. We have to deliver quality services. I would say the last 10 years have said that that is a public relations scam. And what we have watched is major corporation after major corporation go down the tubes, leaving families, workers, communities high and dry. Business cannot do it better. The insurance industry spends 20% on overhead. Social Security spends 4% on overhead and delivers to millions of people every day. So what is very interesting is there is a huge slowing down in privatization.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very, Mildred Warner at Cornell did a very interesting study interviewing upstate New York city council members who are by and large conservative Republicans. And they took a very practical approach to privatization, that they by and large said, okay, we'll privatize 20% of the services and then we'll compare.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, they said, the services were not better, they were not cheaper, morale went down, and accountability went down. And I think this is what the experience is. I mean, mm-hmm. And to me, there's a very practical, ideologically, I believe to have a democratic society, you have to have a public sector. And I don't believe that you can actually set standards and regulate. I think the lesson of government attempts to regulate multinational corporations is that by and large, it's staggering failure.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but fundamentally, I do have an ideological position which says democracy depends on public space and a public sector. And the civil rights movement, by the way, is a struggle over public rights, not over private rights. It's a struggle over public rights. You know, the right to have a job that serves the public, the right to ride in wherever you choose in a public conveyance that serves the public.
Mm-hmm.
And if we diminish, to the extent that we diminish what is public and held in common, we increase the power of the multinational corporations relative to the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you reach a tipping point when a service is no longer a public service, and when government no longer has the capacity to deliver, and at that point they totally lose the ability to regulate. So I think that to me it's an issue of democracy and of maintaining enough common space, public space, so that you actually have the right, as the First Amendment of the Constitution says, freely to assemble and to petition for a redress of grievances. That constitutional right, which also includes freedom of religion and freedom of speech and freedom of the press, in addition to the right of free assembly, it does not apply on private property. And when everything is private, those rights are all suspended. And I think mm-hmm. democracy is gone.
Mm-hmm. Great. Other questions? Yes. Would you mind to use the mic?
Can I just ask it from here just very quickly?
I'll try to repeat it.
Privatization, is what's the way by which you got into this issue.
Mm-hmm.
But with Hutto, you were really looking at the rights of women and children.
Absolutely.
That was the outrage.
Mm-hmm.
What is the condition today, both in the public and private sphere, of women and children that are detained? I mean, you're talking about Arizona. We know Arpaio is going to probably get reelected.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he's asking for more rights, and he's saying, I'm now going to throw everybody in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So are you going to try to undertake that in the public sphere as well, and what is the condition today?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, at Hutto, while the women and children, while the families are gone, it is now incarcerating women. So...
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have children, but we have women there. And many of those detainees were sent to a facility in Pennsylvania, which was a former rest home. So it's a little nicer, but they're still in prison. I think.
And are they immigrant women?
Yes.
Donna?
Yes.
Yeah, okay,
yes.
Quickly.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Immigrant
yeah.
women. Our focus is for-profit incarceration. And I think that's what we will be focusing on. However, in Arizona, it's going to be a moot point. It's all going to be for profit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be just immigrant detainees. It will be everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, that's our slice. But we can't ignore the conditions for women and children across the country.
Yeah, and just to add, We'd love to have the capacity to take that on. It's outrageous. It's appalling. And there are no good prisons. I mean, it's not that the public prisons are a mess. They're disastrous. The policies that this country has are appalling. We imprison people at a rate 6 times that of any comparable nation.
Yeah.
6 times the rate, and we do not have a higher crime rate. And it's completely a war against poor people. It's a war against people of color. It's a war against young people. It's a disgrace in a so-called democracy. Mm-hmm. There's 6.5 of us. We've been successful because we've been very mission-driven and mission-focused. Yeah. If we had another 10 people, we would love to take them on down our bio. We would love to. But as Donna said, what we do is fight private prisons, and we're very good at that. We have an expertise there that we lack when it comes to public prisons. Somebody from Arizona calls up and says, could you come here for a day or two and help us think through the strategy? Sure, we'll do that. But I think part of the secret of grassroots leadership is we have basically learned to say no and to say, we wish we could, we can't.
Mm-hmm.
Are you able to at least harmonize with other groups?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, so I think we actually need to be out of the room, and I mean really out of the room by 8 o'clock, or our wonderful people who help us with the setup and the food and all that won't be able to go home, seriously. So to take care of our great people here, I think we should close it out. I want to give Donna the last word because we're so excited that you're coming in to take on the leadership of this great organization. Do you have a couple words? And then I have a few thank yous to give.
I do. I just think these issues are so important. When we talk about for-profit incarceration, I think we're talking about the values of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're talking about the soul of this country. Are we going to sell that to the highest bidder? Mm-hmm. I certainly hope not.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I want to really give a real personal thanks to Cy. And an organizational thanks to Cy for his great, wonderful leadership. 30 years, leaving a great legacy for Donna to take forward. And I want to very much thank William Johnston, who is one of the longtime supporters of grassroots leadership here at OSI, and Lenny Noisette, and the many others who helped to put together this great event, and all of you for coming out. So thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Is he going to do a song?
You want to do one final song?
Goodbye song?
I'm going to do a fast song. All right, we'll do one. Here. Old fighter, you sure took it on the chin. Where'd you ever get the strength to stand? Never giving up or giving in. You know I just want to shake your hand, because people like you help people like me. Go on, go on. People like you help people like me. Go on, go on. Old battler with a scar for every town, thought you were no better than the rest. You wore your colors every way but down. All you ever gave us was your best. But you know that people like you help people like me. Go on, go on. People like you help people like me. Go on, go on. Old dreamer with a world in every thought, where'd you get the vision to keep on? You sure give back as good as what you got. I hope that when my time is almost gone, they'll say that people like me helps people like you. Go on, go on. Because people like you help people like me. Go on, go on, go on.
Awesome.